Welcome to the European CME Forum podcast. European CME Forum is a not-for-profit organization that promotes multi-channel discussion on matters relating to European and global CME CPD. My name is Eugene Pozniak. I'm the program director of European CME Forum. Today's episode is our last of 2021, so we thought we would do something a bit different to round off the year. For today's episode, I've selected some highlights from the three-legged stool plenary sessions at 14 ECF. You will hear a selection of education experts from around the world discussing their views and perceptions of rules and regulations, educational design and outcomes, and funding and independence, with a final review of the three-legged stool with the session moderators. The first leg on rules and regulations was led by John Bacon, Graham McMahon, Margarita Velcheva, and David Voduszek, and it was moderated by Lawrence Sherman. In this clip, they discussed different stakeholder perspectives.
I think the best place to start is to ask each of you, why do we need rules and regulations? And we, meaning the entire CME enterprise. You can speak from that perspective, speak from your individual perspective, but it's really interesting so that we sort of level the playing field right away and say, why do we need it? So Graham, why don't you go first? I think you'll probably have a really good answer to this one.
Yeah, we've three important stakeholders whose needs need to be met through the regulatory system. Obviously, the first is individual clinicians. Clinicians are in a very specific privileged role of controlling access to medications and devices, and in doing so, have the opportunity to be influenced by the makers of those medicines and devices to prescribe them in some cases inappropriately and in some cases for personal gain. So you want to make sure that the education they're receiving is balanced and evidence-based, and as a result, they can make independent decisions using their professional judgment, not falling victim to promotion and marketing, which doesn't serve their patients' interests. And you need rules and regulations to avoid promotion and marketing and continue education so that physicians can trust the system that they're learning from. The second stakeholder group, of course, is providers themselves. Providers need a level playing field in which they can do their continuing education effectively and consistently, know that they are following the rules, and be able to trust that everyone who's playing in that group is held to the same levels of accountability and structure, and that there are standards for them to meet, that they can operate in a clear and consistent manner. And the third stakeholder group are those that use the credit from the system. So those that manage licensing systems or certification or credentialing systems that recognize the professionalism that's indicated through continuing education credits and participation, having a system that they can trust delivers those programs and manages that system is important for us all.
Great. So Margarita, as a provider, as an organizer, as a representative of good CME, why do you need rules and regulations, and why do we need them around us?
So from the perspective of the provider, I would say to make our life much easier in a way. I will add to what Graham said, to set up the level of criteria expectations for us to follow in order to accredit our educational offerings. We need rules and regulations to know how to properly use funding in order to organize our activity. What are the do's and the don'ts? What would be the proper way for us to develop education that would meet an identified need, a gap, and would reach really, would make actually a change in a physician's practice. So all these things are very important and one of the small aspects of what we need to focus from the provider's perspective.
Thanks. You know, it's interesting because both of you have sort of looked at the positives. I didn't know what was going to come out when I asked that question. So far, we're 2-0 in favor of rules and regulations. David, from your perspective, why do you and why do we within this weird enterprise we chose to be in need rules and regulations?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm I'm also a man of order, you know, so I will not speak negatively about rules and regulations. Although occasionally, of course, we are confronted with, let me put it that way, too much bureaucracy. Let me first start by saying, you know, that I represent the profession, so to speak, the professional organization, a scientific society. And although we also are, see ourselves and are actually a provider of education, we also have many other roles. And some of these roles, you know, may overlap to some extent. So apart from this regulation that Graham has spoken so eloquently about, and I can only agree with him, we also have other, I would say, rules that we need in our everyday functioning. And if you allow me, I may be talking a little bit more about those.
Sure, we'll come back to that. But I think that makes a lot of sense. And you know, it's structure, it's order, it's a framework. So it's all these positives. Funny thing is, my next question was going to be, are there positives? So you've already taken the air out of my balloon. So, John, let's see if we can take the rest of the air out.
I mean, adding on from what everybody said, and I can only agree with that, obviously. I think from, you know, the overarching thing here, why do we have rules and regulations? Well, for me, it's to build trust, and it's to build trust across all of those stakeholders which are represented this afternoon. You know, chaos doesn't build trust, rules and regulations sort of builds trust. But from an industry's perspective, one of the things we're always focusing on is patient safety. So it's another stakeholder group that we are introducing into the discussion today. And, you know, from an industry perspective, for me, it's all about the safe and effective use of medicines and education around that. I know it's quite specific in terms of what I'm saying. But it's about, you know, decisions which Graham already made that are free of inappropriate influence, you know, balanced, accurate, unbiased, words that have already been used before. And, you know, that's why we within the industry rely heavily on the rules and regulations.
Next, they spoke about whether industry is learning anything about providers.
So John, are you learning anything about the provider and accreditor folks that you were not aware of before, aside from how great they are and how much they know? But are there things coming out that you were not aware of?
Well, I think absolutely. And, you know, because we all, well, certainly me, we tend in the industry to live in our own little silo. You know, when we go back to the start of this conversation in terms of rules and regulations, and we focus on the rules and regulations that are most pertinent to us. We don't really understand the environment which the other stakeholders are operating and how they determine rules and regulations. So yeah, it's very insightful to get the, obviously, it from the horse's mouth, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, we live in a world of, well, that's the way they've always done it, so we may as well continue to do it. And I think the awareness factor is a big thing.
Yeah, so, and I think that's a very interesting point, because the world in which we've always done it sometimes comes back to bite us in the proverbial at a later time.
Right. And that's the big question now. Will the new normal go back to the old normal? Is there going to be a different normal, or was there ever a normal? So, you know, it's a challenge for all of us.
Another topic that came up in this session was how to overcome the challenges of abiding by all the rules and regulations.
So David, as we're sort of navigating through this discussion of rules and regulations, you brought up an interesting point before about the layers and the international challenges that you have. Much like I asked Margarita, do you have an example of where you've had to overcome a real challenge to be able to abide by rules and regulations from several things at once?
Well, yeah, I can remember the early days of in our society when we obviously we organize annual conferences, congresses used to be easy in the old days pre-COVID. Anyhow, Also, the congresses, we want to get them accredited. And so in Europe, the biggest accreditor is IACME. They also have agreements with a lot, not all, but a lot of European countries, so that their accreditation is accepted nationally, because in Europe, this is the great issue, basically, whether the national authorities accept any international accreditation. And that's different in different countries. I won't go into details. Back to the problem. So we did that, and the Congress was held in Germany, in Berlin. It was a great Congress. And after the Congress, we realized that it will not be accredited for Germans, because the Germans didn't accept the IACME accreditation unless they also accredit the event by themselves. So it's and it's still, I mean, this you have to be very much aware of all these pitfalls in Europe, because there are so many countries, so different national rules. And although there has been a move towards a more consistent system that would be, quote unquote, more European, there are still many peculiarities that we need to be aware of.
This was followed by a discussion of the FPIA quality standards with all the panelists.
I'm very interested in what FPIA is trying to produce in terms of quality standards, because there seems to be always this risk that industry is trying to promote their own self-accreditation of educational programs and derive some legitimacy from that, as if there isn't a conflict of interest from it. And we've heard from several of our colleagues across Europe that FPIA has approached them to try and get their independently evaluated educational programs accepted for licensure and other CME requirements. And that would seem to be a downward spiral in terms of trying to derive legitimacy for industry promoted events that aren't regulated by an independent accreditor. Is that your view of what FPIA is trying to do? Or are you seeing them as setting standards for CME that's essentially industry doing their own promotion and marketing using educational outcomes in it?
Well, and look, Graham, I have to take the issue with that. That's not what we're about. And, I speak from somebody that's been involved with medical education from an operational side of things. I wouldn't say for one second that, FPR are trying to, build their own rules and regulations. I don't know if you've seen the quality framework, but it talks about collaboration with obviously people like yourselves. Even within Janssen itself, because I can only speak for Janssen, one of the things we're always trying to do with our medical education offerings is get them accredited. Now that is a problematic, because sometimes you say, well, it's industry related, we're not gonna look at it. But it's certainly not what we're trying to achieve here.
And David, I think you wanted to comment on that as well.
Yeah, well, I try to write it down. We at the medical societies who are providing, obviously, education to our members have not seen it, not been delighted with these developments that industry is, since a couple of years now, trying and actually doing its own educational events organized by themselves. Obviously also by hired experts, and promoting it also for CME. And we have argued that, although this is the bias is a very complex issue, and I would be delighted to hear from other participants in the panel how they see it. So bias is really not a simple issue, and it is not something that only industry has to fear. But coming back to what I was saying is that I think the profession, but also possibly even more the society at large, will never look at education organized by industry as biased free. Even if some artificial intelligence would say that an industry generated education is bias free, I don't think the society at large would buy that.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. And, you know, I wonder, Margarita, that sort of as a provider, there's that potential bias, there's the real bias, there's the perceived bias. And you know, as we have to go through that, the steps that Graham outlined before, it's a huge challenge. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
I would like to comment on that. I definitely agree with David. It's a complex issue that we have to deal with this on a daily basis. But as he also mentioned in the beginning of this session, we have very clear outlined documentation, processes, procedures of how we manage bias, very much similar to what Graham was discussing, so all the different steps. And we very diligently implement and apply this to every single one of our activities.
We finish our roundup of the first leg with a comparison of event-based accreditation and provider accreditation systems.
But Graham, there's a question here, and I think it's, Graham, there's immense value in the timely release of medical education, yet the process of accreditation can mean an almost 2-month delay before release. Is there a way to speed this up?
Yeah, it's not a problem we have here in the US because we have a provider-based accreditation system, which allows organizations to deliver education 5 minutes after they think of it, because we don't have a review and approve. We have a trust and verify approach to our continuing education here. It's a process we've recommended to our colleagues at IACME and other international accreditors, but they've yet to adopt it. But those times required for review and approve are, from my opinion, an unnecessary restriction on the flexibility and educational approach and delivery, and are counterproductive in many cases. Our experience with 180,000 activities a year and 1,700 organizations that we accredit is that they are a very trustworthy group, and a trust and verify approach works exceptionally well to both build community capacity and allow flexibility and innovation. So those types of review and approve processes should, in my opinion at least, be abandoned.
The second leg on educational design and outcomes was led by Dean Jenkins, Jean-Philippe Nathalie, Jean Ruggiero, and Mark Westwood, and it was moderated by Robin Stevenson. This clip features the discussion of industry and provider perspective on Don Moore's outcomes framework, the so-called Moore's levels, and education.
So it seems to me that you two have been talking about development gaps. And is it fair for me to ask you, I mean, you finished up, Dean, by talking about behavior change. Is that what you're aiming for? Or are you just aiming, in other words, which level on the pyramid would you say you're generally aiming for?
Practically, we're looking at individual performance level, so a level 4 or level 5 on Bohr's pyramid. Because we are less able to, especially in Europe, to look at patient outcomes. But there are moves to supporting quality improvement programs. So we would usually aim for level 4 or level 5 competency and performance levels.
And John, would you take a similar view, or do you have a different slant on it?
Yeah, Robin, I think it's a great question. It's a really challenging question to answer because I think it really depends on where the evidence lies. For example, what I had shared earlier and the slide that you all saw, if the evidence is emerging and that's leading to our desire to support education, we're probably looking at relevant outcomes like a level 3, a level 4. And there's nothing wrong with that. If there's an individual need for more knowledge, more confidence in data, that would be the levels we're looking for. But if we're in that yellow category where the evidence is somewhat known but being inconsistently applied, we're probably looking at more competence-related and performance-related measures. And the same thing if the evidence is existing. But I do think think it's really important to just understand whether you are in the supporter world and supporting independent education, or you're an educational organization designing education. It's really important to start with the outcome in mind and then back into the design. Don't try to force yourselves to reach a specific level because you think it sounds great. The higher the level is, try to really force the design based on the gap.
Sure. I think you're all singing from the same hymn sheet. So thanks so much for you two. Now, I'd like to ask Eugene to talk about his perspective of the relationship between the provider and industry. Is it a relationship which works well? Could it be improved? Over to you, Eugene.
Hmm. And it's actually interesting to follow Dean's presentation just now as well, because I think it was that the final slide that that Dean showed, which I think raised your question in the first place and said, why isn't there a provider identified on the panel? Because in there, actually, there was no mention of the education provider, the kind that my organization represents, which is standard, as John's been describing, the education provider in the US. We set up the Good CME practice group that we've heard from at this meeting as well. So these are sort of the typical education providers that work within the independent medical education field. And it's actually in the lifespan of European CME Forum, and one of the points that we were looking at the beginning, companies like ours were actually agencies, I mean, like the medical communications agencies of today. There were very few education providers. And that's why we sort of slipped people's minds that we exist. But because of the way industry funds medical education, organizations like ours are taking that independent medical education stance and developing education independently of drug company controlled education. So just in the past 10 years or so, we're seeing a clarity of split. We'd like to see more of the rules and regulations in Europe to clarify that there is a difference between these organizations, and it's what the accreditors expect. But the important thing related to this session is that as organizations move from being, let's say, agents of their drug company clients to the independent medical education providers, is that we now need to move towards becoming educators ourselves and being skilled in identifying all the themes that you're bringing out in this session, and start looking at developing our education with the end in mind, as John just described, and actually being able to design and implement education on this level. So for education providers such as myself, our relationship with the drug company now is different. We're not acting on their instructions. We're developing education perhaps with their guidance. And of course, if we want to attract funding from drug companies, we need to be mindful of the disease area. Yes, their objectives in that, but of course a drug company will only be active in an area where they have a legitimate commercial interest, of course. A dermatology company is not going to start supporting education in gynecology. So there is that, let's call it guidance. But as an education provider, we need to be able to demonstrate to third parties, not just to potential drug company funders, but also to our learners, to the faculty, that we are competent educators and we are able to develop education along these lines.
We then heard the perspective of Mark Westwood, a consultant cardiologist and educationalist.
So now, Mark, can you give your perspective from hospital-based practitioner and how CME impacts on your life, or how you impact on CME?
Yeah, and it was really interesting just listening to that last couple of comments, actually, about the difference between the European and American accreditors. And I think that feeds quite nicely into what I was thinking. And it's also been nice to hear sort of John Rogergo talking about how you start with, when something new comes along, you don't really know what you're trying to address. And therefore, where you are on the pyramid feels slightly crazy. I would agree with that from a hospital point of view. If we took a new innovation or new drug or something, you end up with a split, not just with junior medics or senior medics, but across the entire multi-professional team. You'll sort of have the party of the willing, the party of the ambivalent, and the party of the I don't want to change, usually a third, a third, a third. And if you think about where they are on their journey of adopting, let's say, this new treatment or this using this new drug, so the use of SGLT2 inhibitors, let's say, in the treatment of heart failure or the use of TAVI instead of aortic valve replacement, you're trying to allow people from a hospital point of view to some extent to cater for those that kind of want to go all in and say, I want to learn about this, I want to be taught, I want to understand the evidence, I want this, I want that. You know, I want to spend the entire hospital budget on myself, down to other people who just say, I am not even vaguely convinced by this and I don't want to do it. And it's like, well, if you don't want to be involved, like, how am I going to teach you anything if you've kind of pulled down the hatches? So I think from my point of view, that's really interesting that for the same technology, you can pretty much have people anywhere between about, you know, level one to level five within the CME pyramid, and you're constantly playing this sort of juggling act. Looking at this, obviously we want to feed ultimately into level seven, which is community health, which is a hospital ultimately we should be doing, and certainly into patient health we would hope we would be feeding, which is level six. Seven is virtually impossible. It's really hard to know how you sort of show that you've done that. You feel like, by say, let's say, as a cardiologist prescribing statins left, right and center, I feel I've done something in community health. And maybe if there was some CME behind that had taught me that rosuvastatin or whatever was a drug, maybe that's implicit. But explicitly showing me that, I think, is very difficult. So I always feel in hospital I've just got all seven balls going all at once, and I'm actually having to do, I don't want to call it personalized medicine, but personalized CME. So I'm not sure I've answered your question at all, but I hope that's been useful.
Well, thanks very much, Mark. Actually, you referred a bit to drug development, and that, of course, I was actually trying to get away from that because I thought that John and Dean were talking about drug. I was wondering if you'd like to comment a little bit on what the hospital does to find gaps in its practice. Let's say the hospital-acquired infection rate goes up, or one of the clinics has a very high fallout rate. People don't want to come back. So the hospital has got to look at its own gaps and try to work out what's gone wrong with this particular clinic, or what's going wrong with the infection measures to allow. Now, is that something that you appreciate as part of a physician's obligations, as it were, to his institution?
I would love to answer that question with the following, which is, yes, of course, we have high quality, pan-hospital level strategic quality improvement projects that directly feed into finding educational needs, et cetera, et cetera. And read the answer out of the textbook. The real world of hospitals just isn't somehow quite like that. And particularly in 2021, where we're grappling with waiting lists the likes of which we've never seen before, partial remote and face-to-face consultations, and so it goes on. I think what you started to describe and what I've just described back to you is the sort of holy grail. And exactly as you said, if a patient dropout rate from a clinic is high, first of all, identifying that's the case, that's the first challenge. Then why? Is it clinician-based? Is it evidence? Is it that the evidence has changed? Has something gone on? Is perhaps there something in the community? So, I've got my heart failure clinic, but actually the local GPs in Whitechapel have just, as a consortium, set up a local heart failure clinic, which is much more local to the patients, but actually they didn't tell me, so I didn't know. So the bits don't join up. And without getting into politics, of course, we've been told that the latest reshuffle of healthcare within the UK will address all these problems, the same as the last 10 reshuffles. Of course, we know the reality is it probably will address very little of any of them. But so that's the problem. So I agree in principle about what you've said about, you know, identifying those gaps and those really strategic gaps. That would be a really great way to do all of this. But the reality of what we tend to do is we tend to have people with curricula or people who saw something that they think would be fun and good to do. Like, I want to do this kind of clinic. I want to do this procedure. And it all gets then backwards fitted about around that, rather than perhaps starting with what we should do, which is, if we're really strategic, say, what's the community health? What do we want to change in community health? And then working backwards to how the hospital would support, achieving that objective change at level 7, and then building the CME backwards to support it. That would be the ideal. But I think the reality is it works completely in reverse.
Another topic that came up was informal workplace CME.
And I thought we should perhaps spend a little bit of time on workplace CME, informal workplace CME, which even in the worst of times, doctors still engage in. And so I'm really directing this to you and to Dean, and I'm thinking about point of care CME with your mobile phone and up to date, or with the weekly multidisciplinary team meetings, I think in America called patient care conferences, which started off as being there to improve patient care, but have turned out almost accidentally to be very effective ways of delivering CME. And I often think that these have become very important parts of doctors' life, but they have not been much studied. In other words, no one has stopped to say, I wonder if we're doing our MDT meeting as efficiently as we can to maximize its potential for CME. I just wonder if you two would comment give us your thoughts on informal workplace CME.
Shall I start?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, as a physician, when I became a consultant, I thought, oh gosh, I'm going to be spending lots of time on the ward seeing patients. But I think in reality, you spend a lot of time informally in your doctor's office, going through your reports, or in multidisciplinary meetings. The one that I attend would be the carotid MDT with vascular surgeons, and that's an informal way of really addressing the by a case by case basis, looking at your individual performance and your team's performance on things. So I think it's a highly valuable part, and it's unrecognized. And it reflects what Mark was talking about, the complexity of the world of learning, isn't it? We all like to have these simple models and apply them, but in practice, you have to be quite pragmatic about how the different parts of learning and design come together in the messy world.
Yeah, thank you. Mark, you want to add anything to that?
I'm totally in agreement. I would actually say personally, MDTs are a great way to learn. If you have a really complicated patient, I mean, one of my areas that I do clinically is cardio-oncology. So we've not only the world of cardiology, but it's meeting oncology, and you're trying to work out prognosis with two things that can be competing against each other. And you have to know your evidence base to be able to do that and argue it, you know, coherently with your colleagues, who are going to constructively challenge you because that's what they're there to do. And even as a passive participant, so if I think of the juniors that join those meetings, they'll universally tell you that a well-constructed MDT with the cases that should be there, with the right group of people around the decision-making table, is a really fantastic way to A, review evidence, but B, to learn how to apply that evidence, which kind of takes you quite high up, you know, going back to the pyramid.
Sure.
So I agree, they are informal, but they are a valuable, they're a valuable part of what we do clinically, but they're a valuable part of learning too.
It's like an orphan child wandering around doing good, owned by nobody and recognized. I mean, if there may be some European accreditors listening to us, just now, I don't know if there are or not, but it would do no harm to remind them that activity accreditation is very bad at dealing with workplace CME, as opposed to the North American system of provider accreditation. And it's something I think that European physicians can reasonably be saying to their accreditors, why don't you consider changing to provider accreditation in relation to informal workplace CME?
We finish our roundup of the second leg with a discussion of the French CME CPD system and its applicability to other education systems.
So I'd like perhaps like to open that up to the others. And do we accept that we have a problem in North America and Europe in not having a clearly defined system of gap analysis? Or are we just muddling along and we'll get there anyway? And in fact, we may end up with a more workable system than, if you like, a centralized bureaucratic one, as in France.
I wonder, Jean-Philippe, how well accepted the approach is for a population the size of France to be able to define those grand goals then for CPD. How relevant do they feel that it is then when it is designed in that way?
There is a lot of priority goals. You know, we don't choose just two. Or there is defined by the government. There is 45 priority goals. You know, and each professional board or specialty board defined like 3 to 4 priority goals. You know. The government defines the priority goals by analyzing social health insurance data, you know, to identify where we can do better. And we also define the priority goals, inspiring by, in France, we have health public plan, you know, we have a cancer plan, we have a palliative or end of health plan, you know, and each plan for health problem have a priority goals linked.
Okay,
thank you,
John. What do you think? Do you are you familiar with the American system for identifying prioritizing gaps?
Yes, absolutely, and I am somewhat familiar as well with what Jean-Philippe had just suggested. Though Jean-Philippe is much more experienced in that than I am. And then different regulations around different regions across the world. I think that what happened in the United States was once the Affordable Care Act went into place, known broadly as healthcare reform during President Obama's administration, there was a great call for regulated data so that health systems would begin to capture the areas where they were deficient by three specific goals. One of them was deficiency in the overall patient experience and patient satisfaction, patient choice. The second was overall deficiency in clinical gap and perhaps, clinical deficiencies that lead to care disparities, care variation, as well as dangers in care choices, things that were not concordant with national guideline. And then the third was any kind of deficiency that caused the overall care process to be overly expensive in an unnecessary way. And so health systems were being challenged to actually examine that, to do some self-reflection and then collective reflection. What I have found amazing is that in the United States, at least, Canada I cannot speak to because they have a different system. But in the United States, there hasn't been this gravitational pull toward using education, certified medical education, in a way to actually help the systems correct this. And I think in listening to Mark and Jean-Philippe and Dean and obviously Eugene, in listening to everything that they're saying, there's a recognized trend that is just appearing in my mind. Dean said it best when moments ago he just said, healthcare is a very complicated situation. I think, Mark, you said this too. It's very complex. Decision-making is very complex. Very easy to suggest what model is best, what level is best. But when you think about it, you know, we have to start recognizing that healthcare decision making has changed from when Dr. Moore first published his information. Healthcare decision making is no longer hierarchical. It's no longer decided by a pyramid. It's no longer suggesting that one level is better than the other. It's actually more circular, with decision makers being collaborative around one another. That's what a system means. And I think the time has come for us to absolutely respectfully use the standards in front of us, use the evaluation process in front of us, can include Dr. Moore's levels of published literature, which has been an incredible help to our industry, meaning the educational industry, for quite a long time, but add on to that different components and different theories and models and practices that really address this complex healthcare decision-making environment that you all heard my other colleague panelists talk about.
The third leg was on funding and independence, and this was led by Pamela Beaton, Elizabeth Kelly, Sophie Wilson, and Michelle Smith, and this was moderated by Ron Murray. The first clip from this session includes provider and accreditor perspectives on financial support from industry.
Can I ask you, Sophie, what's your current experience of trying to get support, financial support for your activities? Are you finding it more difficult? Are you finding that the amount of money available has decreased? Just give us an idea of where you think the playing field is.
I think in Europe, it used to be much, much more, ad hoc, unsolicited requests, whereas in the US, the sort of grant portal system was much stronger. But I think in the Europe now, we're getting many more portals. And so there's much more guidance, and which makes it easier, because I think you've both touched on this thing of vocabulary, because we apply for grants or unrestricted grants. You know, what do we apply for money to fund a specific project. But not only do we have to conform to your vocabulary, your criteria, but we also have to conform to the criteria of the accreditors. And so, you know, some accreditors will only accredit something if you say it's an unrestricted grant, but no grant is ever unrestricted. It may be arm's length. So we have to do a lot of education of the accreditors as well, so that they can understand where our money comes from, how it's used, that it's arm's length, that it's proper CME, et cetera, et cetera. So that it's interesting. And I think it's great that a lot of the portals now have proper definition, you know, they define what they're asking for, because it really, really helps us as providers.
So Michelle, as an accreditor, do you need some education on support? And can you give us an idea of, you know, what you think your role is and how you deal with it in Canada?
Yeah. So again, similar to in the US, where we have providers that do the accrediting of activities, our role is just to define what the rules of engagement, I guess, would be. So right now, the Royal College and the Canadian, the family physicians are working together to update a document that we have that clarifies what the support can be. And the guidance is really about creating transparency and, you know, who has the final say in an educational activity, who can sit on the planning committee. And that's really, from our standpoint, that's where we want to be. We want to allow the providers to work with funding from whatever source. It's more about the outcome and how that's generated. So we don't really get into, you can't talk with them, or you can talk with them, or is it a grant? Is it a sponsorship? It's really about just clarifying, you know, where the role is and how you determine that.
Another topic that came up was the use of multiple supporters for funding education.
Another topic that's come up that I'd like all of you to sort of consider and respond to is this whole concept of multiple source support. And in some situations, it's seen as being preferred. And I think in other situations, some providers are scared of it. Now, I know that that you and Pam, your companies actually do ask for grants coming into you in a joint way. So is it something that the grantors are keen on in seeing grants coming from other sources apart from themselves?
So certainly at Lilly is that unsolicited grants that are multi-supported are kind of preferred. I mean, from an RFP perspective, then they will tend to, on the whole, be single supported, but sometimes they can also be multi-supported. If they, again, you know, a good provider will know, you know, perhaps other companies who would also know that that was a gap for them as well. And that, so they may approach other providers as well. So,
is that something that you've experienced, Sophie? Have you applied for multiple source support?
Over the years, yes, we have done multiple source support. We have a couple of regular conferences that are multi-supported in the HIV area. And for sort of conferences, meetings, it seems to be easier. But we've had some online educational initiatives in the past that have been multi-supported. They're not our main bread and butter, but we do try. But quite often, some of the supporters want to be founding supporter and get that cachet, and it's difficult to get that balance. I mean, I think where we've managed to do it successfully has been where we've been running a conference that was multi-supported, and then we've rolled something out of that because everybody knows what they're getting, and that everybody's in there on an even footing. Whereas, I mean, some funders, if you want to do an initiative, an online initiative, for example, that's quite big, the need changes, it develops. It might be a curriculum that runs over 2 years. So you might set a goal at the onset and set some initial projects, but then you don't quite know where it goes because it's up to your learners and the needs will change in that year and you have to be flexible and adaptable. But some funders need to identify something specific to fund. So, you know, it might be some specific elements, some of them from a compliance perspective require a specific identified thing to fund. And if you're doing a big initiative that you want to roll out as a curriculum, that can sometimes be quite difficult.
Yep,
So Sophie's raised a really important point. So, I mean, often a program that we fund will last over a year, but we know the therapeutic environment could be changing quite rapidly. Mm. So it might be that the guidelines are going to be changing. It might be that a drug gets approved and that will change that landscape. So one of the things that I like to see in a grant proposal is where that is acknowledged and how the provider is going to address that. So they may launch their program. So say they're launching a program in January, but they know an approval is likely in April or whenever, that they make then an update to that program, especially those virtual programs. And I like that to see that in the grant, that as the guidelines change, as the, as I said, a new drug approval or whatever it might be, to make sure that their program that is running for a year is adapted to ensure that it's up to date. There's nothing worse than, you know, funding a program knowing that in the 12 months that it's going to be running, it's going to be out of date.
Yeah. You're right. That flexibility is so important. It? And it's not just the guidelines and new drug launches. It's also, you might find after the first 3 months, you know, your steering committee had one idea of where the need was, but actually, as you're moving through those first 3 months, you realize that there's a huge gap that has opened up. And so you need that flexibility.
Yeah, and so thinking about that, the sort of quality and skimping in your submission, that's, you know, if you can include that, that really shows you understand the, you know, the needs, the gaps, and the therapeutic area that you're wanting to get funding on that educational program.
Pam, are you involved in any of these sort of situations where you will be providing support in collaboration with another industry member?
So I personally, my colleague does. I will say to Liz's point, I think the key thing we saw last year is a lot of providers were submitting year-long activities for COVID. Yeah. And I'm like, we don't know what happened yesterday. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I will say one of the challenges, like I said, my colleague manages our alliance with Lily, actually. But for me, and I'm sort of reading some of the comments, one of the challenges, I think, when it comes to multi-support is not only are each funder's requirements are different based on their portals and their expectations and so on and so forth, is some providers will ask for higher level outcome, or I mean, some supporters will ask for higher level outcome than I'm willing to support. So if one of our peer companies wants level 5, and I personally think that that this activity only reaches maybe level 3 or level 4, particularly if it's in rare disease, I think that can be challenging. And I do feel for the providers that I want multi-support, but we are asking for different levels of outcomes, which may not actually align with the content and format. So I think that's an area which can definitely, I think, where having an alliance may help, because then you can align on sort of what your expectations are for a particular activity.
We round up the third leg highlights with a discussion on substance over sparkle.
Was it you or Pam that said develop substance, not sparkle? Yeah. That was Pam. Tell us what you mean by that. I think it's a great line, Pam.
So I use this quite a bit. When it comes to, and we sort of touched on it a lot in terms of the quality, not the quantity, but what I'll see sometimes in grant proposals is these cool things, that this cool platform, this cool thing you do where you engage learners and, you know, you e-blast them and they do all these things, but it doesn't actually tell me how this particular activity you're requesting funding for meets, or this cool innovative way, and I use the term innovation, we're actually trying to move away from it at my organization. You know, people will talk about innovation, sort of the sparkle, and it'll be sort of this shiny new toy, but it doesn't have to be. It can be perfectly simple. To Liz's point, you don't have to meet 10,000 learners with something that might have interaction and video games and da 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 da. If you can change practice of maybe 100 learners with something simple and unique. Just because you have video games, and I mean, I realize that we have Gather Town and we get to walk around and I almost feel like I'm in the Oregon Trail, which is super cool, but how is that going to move the needle for the learners? So unless you can tell me how it's gonna move the needle for the learners, don't throw it in there.
You agree?
Yeah, and I think, and again, it brings up at the point below, which is like knowing your learners. So again, you know, one of the things that you know, that we find a challenge sometimes is that, you know, we'll get these, you know, a really innovative, flashy kind of idea, but then it'll go to every single grant committee. So whether it's my colleagues in diabetes or in immunology or whatever, and that's why you need to know who your learners are and know what your therapy area is, and you know, that particular gamification or fancy tool might work really, really well for one particular type of clinician in one therapeutic area, but actually will not translate necessarily into, you know, oncology, for example. So And that's why it's really, really important to know who your, you know, your end learners are, whether that's a community physician, whether that's a, you know, a scientific expert in a academic center or whatever. Know who they are. If it's a nurse or a pharmacist, those again will be different. So it's really, really important. And just because you've got a great tool doesn't mean that you have to include it in every single submission that you have.
The final review of the three-legged stool was led by Lawrence Sherman, Ron Murray, Robin Stevenson, and myself. In this session, we reflected on the plenary sessions and discussed the importance of outcomes and gap analysis.
So when I'm looking at all the comments that were coming in, the single most voted for comment in all three of the sessions were about outcomes, okay? And that's where, if you add up all the votes for all of the responses, also it was outcomes. Now, does that surprise you, Ron?
No, it doesn't, because I really think that the message has been received, and it's that people are now understanding that at the end of the day, you can't just do it for the sake of doing it. As Pam said there, you know, it's not about the sparkle, you know, it's about the substance, and we've gone through the whole thing, but the planning mechanism. I agree with you. I thought the parallels in each one were really quite remarkable. And one of the things that came out for me, yes, outcomes mentioned over and over and over again, but the willingness of representatives from the different stakeholders to actually, it seems that we've been talking a long time about this idea of collaboration, but it looks as if they're actually doing it and or really wanting to do it. And the, you know, the roles of the accreditors in helping the providers, providers helping each other, the funders helping as well. I think it's, you know, it bodes well for the future for us.
Yeah, you know, Robin, when Don's paper came out in 2009, I think what happened was people rushed to say, okay, now we have to measure outcomes without thinking about how do you get to the outcomes, right? So they weren't necessarily always tying it back to needs, gaps, objectives. I think what we've seen in the 12 years since is that evolution. Is that what you sort of get out of it now? And that's why people want to understand higher level outcomes?
Yes, I think people have now realized that perhaps a better description for needs assessment is gap analysis, because it's more expressive of what you actually do.
Yeah.
I've noticed in the past few years, people are more aware that unless there's some gap there, you've no business providing education.
We then moved on to the idea of the four-legged stool.
Somebody, Eugene, suggested that maybe there's four legs to this stool: the HCP, the professional body, the employer, and the regulator. I would argue that we could build a warehouse full of stools. And it really is dependent upon who we want to sit on the stool. I think in your case, as I think about it, you want the HCP to sit on the stool, because the HCP, the learner, needs to have a stable environment in which to learn. But if you're looking at the profession, well, then I think that four-legged stool makes sense.
But that's interesting. It's looking at a sort of different kind of stool. But over the years, we're seeing additional stakeholders coming to the table. Of course, yeah, healthcare professionals. We've heard a few times over the past couple of days, it's sort of looking outside of us talking to ourselves. Yeah. And I'd like to see much more discussion, exploration of big data, but not on a national level, but even on a hospital level. I think Mark Westwood was talking about his own healthcare system, saying the data exists, quality improvement departments exist in these hospitals, but they don't talk to the education side. They don't say, we've identified this huge gap. There are departments in the hospital that are perhaps performing not as well as they should. And then there's no dotted line to, why don't we create some kind of CPD or educational, get the team together to start addressing this. So I think this disconnect really needs to be looked at in Europe, especially.
We concluded the session with a conversation on looking ahead.
I think we can shift now to what the future looks like, right? I think we've covered that. I know we're going to look at the three-legged results soon. I know you're waiting for your stool sample, but...
You had to get
I had to. I've been waiting 48 hours for that. So as we look forward, I think we learned a lot from the last 18 months. I think, and one of the things I've seen from outside of just CME is that we were far ahead of some of the other parts of the educational continuum, because we've been doing e-learning for a long time. And I think some of our best practices wound up being adapted and adopted by undergraduate and postgraduate trainers because they had to find a way to educate and pivot quickly, right? So what do you think is going to stay from the changes that we've seen from the pandemic and how we had to respond? And what do you think we're going to go back to?
John put it really nicely. John Ruggiero, was it? Yeah. Or Mark, it was your session, Robin. It was, there's a normal. We're going to, but it's, we're not returning to the old normal. But it's not really a new normal. It's got to be something different. I think it'll be a mistake to go back to doing things before. And just even the two questions that I've asked at the beginning of the 2 days about a future CME forums, what's that going to look like? Are we going to go back to Barcelona doing what we did in Manchester 2 years ago? Well, it's got to be something different. But the big thing, I think, is the digital side. How are we going to incorporate this? Yeah. And the digital, even this meeting compared to the last meeting, the level of digital literacy of the delegates, the skills of the faculty and moderators, just internet connectivity around the world has evolved hugely just in 12 months.
And comfort, no joke, turning ourselves into Mario and Luigi and running around Gathertown and talking to people, right? Mm. 3 years ago, Robin, you would have said to me, that's ridiculous. No one would ever do it, right? But I think it's real. But I think it also provides an opportunity for us. And I'm interested in what you folks out there think as well. But I think we'll see far more hybrid, true, honest-to-goodness hybrid, where we're bringing in the learners who've never been able to participate in a lot of our live face-to-face education. So it's going to give us an opportunity to help upskill faculty, reskill faculty, identify new and innovative ways to deliver that. I think our learners will be appreciative of it.
That was members of the 14 ECF faculty discussing themes from the three-legged stool at 14 ECF. If you attended the meeting, please complete the brief post-meeting survey and let us know your thoughts. As you'll have seen during the meeting, your feedback is really important in our future planning. We've already started updating the website. You can find the posters, and we will continue to add presentations, videos, and reports, and other outputs from the meeting over the coming weeks. Registered participants will also have exclusive access to recordings from the meeting sessions, which will be made live in the new year. Publications from the JECME 2021 Special Collection are also regularly being published, so keep an eye on the JECME webpage for these. Thank you for listening. I wish you and your loved ones a happy holiday season and peaceful new year. And join us for more episodes as we continue through 2022 to explore all things CME CPD.